interview with Warren Randall.
Start it. Question number one.
All right. My name is Warren Randall. Presently, I am in the Department of Undergraduate Studies as an assistant vice provost. I came to Stony Brook November 20th, 1963, which is a date that should stick in people's minds because it's the day that Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah. I was, how old was I at the time? 20, now I got to figure out how old I was. 29, I guess. 28. I came here from a position in another state agency, the State Insurance Fund, where I was a senior personnel administrator. And I came here, I was interviewed by Maurice Kostrin and Carl Hartzell, who occupied a little room in the Humanities Building. The reason I came here was that promotion avenues were closed off, and I figured that this is a new institution and one to grow with.
What was your function initially?
Came here as financial secretary, which is basically an assistant business officer. And under Kostrin, I supervised personnel functions, purchasing. He took care of research. I had the switchboard, and shared fiscal plant, and that type of things. Now, of course, there are separate vice presidents for every conceivable function you can mention.
That's the way things went. Lots of hats were worn by a single individual, the gentleman. And lots of functions were performed by a single building, the gentleman.
My original office was in the library before they put the shell up. I occupied the second floor, and I recall that the wing went from actually John Toll's office through a whole series of assistants to the president to the business office, which went along the south wall to include purchasing.
This is the
old
Intercorp. Intercorp, yeah. Present library.
Where they had the nice winding stair to come up to the second floor. And the book check-in was on the first floor. He's no longer with us, but I remember E.J. Capello was down on the first floor. Myron Bissett. Who else was here? Shortly after that, we moved out of the library into the infirmary where the business office was then located for about 5 years until we moved to the administration building. My initial reaction to the campus was, of course, they had just finished putting up the basic core buildings, which were G&H Quad. They haven't even started on the gym then or the infirmary, but it was library, old chem, old bio, humanities.
Old physics.
I have to run the back in the numerical order. And that was about it. You came in, they've moved the road so many times, I've forgotten where it is, but you made the left turn off Nichols Road. You came in along a long driveway, which is presently a parking lot.
Yes, right.
Most of the physical plant was built with a small boiler, and the physical plant yard was basically in place. It gave the impression of being a small little upstate school, because this was right after the first rush of construction, but before the second rush of construction came. And of course, since I've been at Stony Brook, we've gone from 8 buildings to 100 and whatever it is now.
Yeah, Yes, we kept school in the middle of a construction site.
It's an interesting question. Having been here for 9 out of 25 years now, the pragmatism of the campus is what sticks out in my mind in terms of the official line. The company policy was, let's do what has to be done to get this thing moving, and then we always stood around with egg in our face when everyone second-guessed what we did. How come you did that? Why didn't you think of this? When you're building, you know, 30 or 40 buildings at one time, and you're going from, when I came here, we had 500 students, a little over 500. Within the first probably 6 years.
Let's see, when did you come?
63.
63. Yes. In 62, we lost quite a few students because we moved from Oyster Bay out here. We lost some of the local students from Nassau.
Mm-hmm.
63, I think we had more than 500. I thought we had around 700, something like that, at any rate. Well, it was under 1,000.
Of course, I remember that they were still doing some busing. I remember the bus drivers, Tony Olivo, who has since left the campus, but I think is still around. We'll probably have some interesting recollections about the bus transportation.
Biology was still operating on the Oyster Bay campus during 62-63. I think they moved 63.
Yeah, well, the dorms had opened when I got here in 63, G&H. I understand that before they moved to the library, part of the business office operation was indeed located in some empty bedrooms over in G&H.
Right, in G.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing I remember about 63, 64 was the fact that there was enough parking places on campus. And even though you only had to go, quote, across the street, which is now the gym for the library lot, people complained that they wanted to park right next to the building. Remember in the basement of the library, we had the print shop, which consisted of a Xerox machine with Andy McDonald, who was probably still around. I remember the stacks, the library stacks, being the equivalent of just the second floor. That's about as far as they went.
Second floor?
Of the old library with the
yeah,
stacks
yeah.
Before the collection expanded. Personal point of view, the one thing I've found fault with, of course this is in retrospection, was that we were so busy doing things, and this is from the top down when John Toll came, that no one ever sat down to discuss with the staff the vision for the future. What is this campus? It was so much doing everyday work that, you know, if you heard that, oh, we plan in 20 years to have 15,000 students, 20,000 students, that was all pie in the sky, but no one ever sat down and said, this is where we're going to go. This is what our emphasis is going to be. It was all extremely pragmatic and occasionally very surprising in terms of, oh, are we going in that direction now? Fine. We did a lot of, on the same note, there's a lot of building going on, but very little evidence of planning in terms of, and this is not a fault of the campus, this is a fault of the system. We build the building. Construction fund approves the money, they stick the building up, but it doesn't seem to be integrated with the campus in terms of, here's the building, we have to come back and say we need parking spaces, we need roadways, we need paths, we need this. We put up a building and the first thing we do is rehab it because purpose changed, ideas changed. So in that respect, we emphasize too much the building and too little. Where does it fit in?
Communication between the campus and the construction fund in Albany and the central office in Albany was was a problem, a distinct problem. I don't know whether it still is or not. But
nobody has a vision for the campus that has been reduced to worries that or discussion that people participate in. This is now 1988. We're undergoing master plans for year 2000. These people are going around, and nobody's quite sure who they're speaking to in terms of who's setting the agenda for the campus. What input is there into the campus?
What people are they? Are they our people?
Now, these are outside consultants from... all right, the memory starts to go. Consulting firm. The name will come to me.
All right.
Perkins Will, I think, something like that. I have to speak personally that one of the things that happens on this campus is, and this might not be liked, but I've seen it, I've suffered from it, I've seen others that suffer. There is a degree of elitism on campus. There's a degree of cronyism on campus, which sometimes detracted from the mission of the campus, that people who really didn't deserve to be where they are got where they are for whatever reason. There are many different types of reasons.
Well, now, was this in the, within the faculty? Was it in the administration?
This is, I pass no judgment on the academic mission. I'm just talking in terms of the administrative responsibilities that had to be carried out, that you came upon incompetence, which their incompetence was repeated and repeated, and they seemed to just survive. Whatever their skill or technique was, occasionally it worked against the best interest of the campus. And the elitism, I feel, because the campus community consists of academicians who have academic degrees and credentials, and the people who work to make sure that their classrooms are clean, that they have supplies when they need them. There's a tremendous gulf on this campus, more so than I've really experienced in other schools that I've been to or that I've visited. And it's unfortunate because we're losing a great deal of individual power by this forced chasm that exists between, quote, the academic community and the people that serve the academic community. It's unfortunate, but part of this was reflected, being perfectly frank, from the top down, that until the most recent administration, which is Jack Marburger's, there was no recognition of an SG employee or an NTP employee per se. If an academician received some type of honor, it was well publicized. If someone other than an academician received it, nobody knew about it, even though it was within their particular field, profession, something noteworthy. And I think that this tone was set way back when, and just nobody pay attention to it. I don't know if I can fault who. Well, assigning fault is not productive, but nobody called attention to the fact that this is a problem that should be addressed. I've tried to do it in recent years, and there's been some progress that we're all on this boat called Stony Brook together.
Right. There's a new man who's been brought in from Chicago. I'm not sure whether it's the university or not, by the name of Rose. He has the title of Vice President for Personnel something.
No, he's the Director of Personnel for the West Campus, as opposed to Alice Harp, who's Director for the East Campus, reporting to Krauss, who's the Associate Vice President for Human Resources. The campus is trying to deal with a problem. I mean, if you want to go into the question of are we one campus or two campus, and relive memories of Ed Pellegrino, et cetera. I'll be happy to do that, but that's one of the other problems that is confronting us to this day. Are we one campus with one mission, or are we health sciences and the rest of the world? That's beyond me.
Well, that's one of the problems that the Muir Commission recognized and talked to me about when they first came, that they didn't want to recommend that a new comprehensive health science center be built on the campus of an existing strong institution. One reason they picked Stony Brook was that they hoped that the two would grow together, Stony Brook administration and the Health Sciences Administration would have a certain amount of unity and a certain amount of communication back and forth. That was the idea, that was the goal. That's one reason that they gave the report said that the first new health science center should be built at Stony Brook, in the 63 report of the Muir Commission.
Well, part of the problem is that for whatever reason, when you put up institutions that are supposed to grow together, even though it's the same problem you have trying to compare this campus with Buffalo. We're separated by several hundred miles, so there are different administrative techniques and procedures within the same broad guidelines that apply. When you have them physically close together, you have a personnel policy, for example, which doesn't coincide, so you go across the road and you're treated differently than you are on this side of the campus. And because, you know, it could be members of the same family, that creates problems. So instead of having a unified policy that applies both sides of the road, it seems that they're doing everything individually and not the same way that, quote, the main campus is doing it, which creates the problem. I mean, we went through that of do the rules apply? They have their own procedures manual, but they follow the state procedures manual, and the interpretations differ. So unless you have one person calling the shot saying, this is what our policy is going to be, and this is what our procedure is going to be, and within that policy and procedure, be my guest, they didn't do that. They went and did their own procedures, we have our own, and it creates problems, both strictly in terms of interpretation. I'm sure when they put up the Veterans Hospital, which is under a different state agency, we'll have a third set of, you know, problems.
Incidentally, where is that going to be?
That's going to be south of the Health Science Center, I believe. On the piece...
South of Fields Lane.
Yeah, the piece between here and the Christian Science.
The 40 acres down there.
Yeah. Okay. And then there's some other stuff that I understand is going to be... go out towards Palm Path. And then we're now looking... for space to put up housing to bring us into the 21st century. I see we're restricting to 1971.
Huh? Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Although the assumption was that the events prior to that time would be more difficult to recover.
You know, this includes, from a personal point of view, a very difficult time because I had my little run-in with the vice president from finance and business that they brought in from the University of Michigan, who apparently didn't realize that he was living in New York State.
Joe Diana. You want to tell me something about that? Why did they bring him in and what were his functions and so on? I have very little on that. I got a little from John Burness.
Basically, going back when, as I indicated, the way this place operated was you do what you can with what you have, and you try to sort out everything later. Of course, this is not, quote, good business technique, but you have to get things done. You don't have sufficient people to do the job, so you have one person doing two or three jobs, which also, quote, is not good business practice. Back in the late 60s, it was 1965, I guess, they hired a vice president for administration, Wilbur Edel, who was here about a year and a half, I think, or 2 years. I'm not quite sure of the time. When he left here and took another position, equivalent Ohio, with Hunter College, if I remember correctly.
I think it was York, wasn't it?
No, he went to Hunter. He went into the university system. That, of course, left Castro and myself back in charge as we were. And we underwent an audit in 1967, which basically covered every transaction that took place from the time the institution was started, because we did not have a state audit prior to that.
Including Charlie Cooper, in other words.
No, that's right. It went all the way back to 1957. Conway.
Conway.
A business officer that preceded Custer and myself were Charlie Cooper, who I understand is at Wagner in Staten Island, and Milt Ginsberg, who is at Maritime, Stuart Maritime, unless he's retired. They left, Custer and I came in. Maurice came here, I think, in May of 63. I came in November, something like that. Our staff consisted of basically Vince Ruggi, who was a payroll clerk, Charlie Gulo, who was a purchasing agent. No one functioning in personnel that I can remember. Vince wore two hats, payroll, personnel type function. The physical plan was under Clint White, if I remember correctly. And that was basically it. Charlie Burke handled research administration.
Hello? Where does he come in?
He was the facilities person, construction, all sorts of things. He wasn't under the business office per se. He reported to the president, or the chief administrative officer, whatever title you're using there. Myron Doucette was a special assistant to the president, and that was about it.
He was for finance. He was for scientific
equipment, yeah. And Linda Weaver was the bursar function in that thing. There was no separation yet of the accounting process. That was more or less basically under purchasing, subject to Costrin's signature and my signature. The auditors came in. Because we didn't have the staff to maintain the books, we were pretty well raked over the coals. A lot of the stuff we did in terms of advances, things like that, they questioned. There was never any question of dishonesty, question of poor procedure, and suspicion. Edel left, the report came out, they did a national search and came up with Joe Diana. He brought in with him Carl Haynes, who was still here, Joe Hamill, and Jerry Gilman. Now, as I understand it, and this is pure rumor, that Albany is the one who insisted on Diana. They wanted to promote no one from within the system to come in and clean house. The second thing is that because he was coming from outside the system, he agreed to take Joe Hamill, who was an internal auditor who had experience of working at the Upstate Medical Center in Syracuse. So he could help him through the ins and outs of the state bureaucracy. Haynes came because Diana worked with Haynes back in the University of Michigan, and Haynes was the chief accountant or something for the research activity out of the University of Michigan. Jerry Gilman, I don't know where he came, he only lasted here a year, and he said, I can't work here, and he left. This was a way station. The other person that Diana brought with him was Don Butera, who was supposed to function as the Director of Management Information Systems and Chief Internal Auditor, wearing two hats.
When did Gerstel come in?
Gerstel was about a year later, and McConkie was about a year later. They were here from the Haskins and Sells audit team that came in after the state controller finished up. Diana came here in February 1970. My introduction to him was, he walked into the office, he said, "He's Joe Diana." I was quite forthright in stating what the problems we had, because they were all well documented. Basically, it turned around that his sole purpose, initial purpose, was to get rid of Koshin and myself. Maurice, of course, being in state service for a relatively long time, took it for about 10 months and then he put in his papers and retired. He said, quite frankly, he didn't have to put up with this type of nonsense, so he just left, because Diana's treatment of individuals on campus was very unprofessional. Myself, being a career civil servant, refused to knuckle under to the pressure, because through his deputies, he suggested that I might want to look for a job elsewhere, that he knew that there was a position open here, open there, why don't I look for it? I said, "I have years of state service, I've been here. You indicated that you were building a new organization and there was a place for me in it." I said, "You seem to have changed your tune." The next thing I know, they have served me with papers. 143 charges were on it, covering everything from my allegedly approving illegal overtime for the plant to spitting on a sidewalk for all intents and purposes. Fortunately, I have maintained my own file of important documents, because one of the things that Mr. Diana did, which of course didn't sit too well with me, was backdate memos. If I sent him a memo saying X, Y, and Z, this should be done, or what have you, or there's a problem because the state rule says you should do this, and you hadn't done it, and let's correct the situation, he would send me a memo dated a week before my memo, directing me to do something as if I am responding improperly to him. Now, all this stuff, I had date stamped when it came in, and I saw what he was doing, I started to accumulate the files, which served me in good stead when we had to go to a hearing. I was suspended for 15 months. I was on special assignment, worked at home, under Gerstel. I was without pay for a month, which was returned to me because the hearing officer, after roughly 3,500 pages of testimony, of which I have, questioned basically why were the charges brought in the first place. To quote him, he says, "There's not one scintilla of evidence," and it goes on like this. Of course, shortly after I came back, John Toll said, "Oh, he's not going to appeal the decision," but he couldn't appeal it because the decision was final. Joe Diana, of course, left and went elsewhere. Butera left and went elsewhere. Hamill left and went elsewhere. Gilman left and went elsewhere. And
do you know where they are now?
Gilman went, I think, to the University of Oklahoma. Joe Hamill went out to the University of Washington. Where he is now, I don't know. Butera, after he left here, it took him quite some time. He's floated around. I'm not quite sure where he's working now. Last I heard, he was down. He had gone to Florida, lost his job there, and was trying somewhere else. Joe Diana went from here to the University of Illinois at Urbana, and then he went to the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago, which was a nice thing. It's nice to see all these people going up, as it were. And now has since retired and is in private business somewhere. And basically, I've survived this, The charges he brought against me ranged from actually grand theft, because at one registration period, the bursar said, all these people are coming in with checks, I don't have the change. And I said, let's get the change, and you'll make change, and you don't have to bother with it. And he accused me of making off with $15,436 in cash. Of course, during the preliminary investigation, a whole series of things that went on, there was documentation there showing the redeposit of the money over a period of time as the bursar used it and what have you. He accused me of making off with somebody's NDSL checks, of converting it to cover these shortages. And it was documented that this person was not entitled to his check, and his check had been sent back to Albany. He never had gotten the money. Things like this. There are also a goodly number of charges and specifications dealing with the Stony Brook Foundation, which I had something to do with when it first was organized, but those were withdrawn. Basically, it was attempt to remove me unfairly, I think.